Good evening, this is Gary Kavner here on the right side. I'm here today with my friend and colleague Michael Dwyer. Today is the 2nd of December. I'm sure you've enjoyed the day of Christmas songs you have no doubt been subjected to in your house. Today we wanted to talk about not really a particular news story as such, although it relates to something that's in the news, but more of a general idea. We noted when we were going through all of the papers trying to figure out what we'd actually talk about today, that an incredible amount of the news is either about Verona Murphy, Fine Gael's by-election candidate, who did very well, and it was either about her explicitly, or it was about her implicitly. And a lot of it was talking about the rise of anti-immigrant sentiment. Almost all of them said far-right sentiment. And it was just something that's quite interesting. And it's this, it's that a lot of the people who are anti-immigration in Ireland are not right-wing. They are left-wing. But Irish commentators don't seem able to actually understand that. They seem to only think of the political compass in a left-right scale, and they attribute things to right-wing, which are not really economic beliefs at all. They don't go onto the left-right scale, they go onto the libertarian-authoritarian scale. But they don't seem able to differentiate it, so everything becomes far-right. And I imagine you've noticed this as well, Michael.
Yeah, I think that what is happening is that if somebody has an opinion which they construe, and I'm not saying in this case, to be clear, that I'm necessarily of the same opinion as they are regarding the seriousness or the content or the nature of the comments made by Verona Murphy. But if they see somebody making a statement which they perceive as being a racist or xenophobic or whatever, that means that it is a priori, that means that person is right wing. That you cannot be left wing and have those kinds of opinions. It's a bit like a no true Scotsman argument, isn't it?
It is, but it's also very weird because I remember I was doing a debate in UCD a while ago, and they asked me to speak in favour of Trump's border wall. Now, I have no opinion on Trump's border wall at all because I don't care. I know too little about it to have an opinion, but I know enough about it to argue for a side in a UCD debate. But someone stood up after me and started talking about how we were, how the people who wanted to build a border were slaves and servants of billionaires seeking to expand the capitalist project. And all I could think of is Bernie Sanders when he was asked, did he support open borders? And he said, no, that's a Koch brother idea.
Absolutely. And the Koch brothers, for those who don't know, the Koch brothers are two of the most famous libertarians and funders of libertarian ideas and politicians in the United States.
One of them is now fictitious.
Well, yes, one of them has gone to the great beyond, I think, has he?
Oh, yes, very much so.
So fictitious? Anyway, okay.
Fictitious. He's no longer real.
Okay, we won't get into the metaphysics of the Koch brothers, but anyway, I think that one of the things that may be going on here, let's be nice, is that there is an assumption with people who are not maybe that interested in politics of the left or the history of the ideas of the left, that there is only one left. There is only one expression of socialism or leftism. And that is the form which is called the internationalist. And that if you are a person of the left, you must therefore be perforce internationalist. And yet we know that this isn't true because we know again and again that one of the constant themes at different times, in different places, for the last 100 and more years has been precisely the notion of bringing in cheap labour, immigrants, in other words, to suppress the wages of the native workers and to take their jobs away and let with the poor
poor people from poor countries who will work for half nothing. And that is that kind of economic, that's an form of economic protectionism. And economic protectionism is not his, I would say in the last 100 years anyway, has tended to be an idea more of the left than of the right. It hasn't always been that. One of the great arguments of the end of the 19th century in British politics was precisely about the idea of free trade. That was the great thing that distinguished liberals from Tories in the 19th century. But most conservatives of the 19th century have actually adopted most of the economic clothes that would have been used by the liberals, 19th century liberals, and economic and the belief in free trade. And the belief that free trade, while it will have localised negative effects, when taken globally, will have an overall positive effect on your economy.
Yeah, I don't think people nowadays accept. I don't think people nowadays accept that it will have negative effects locally. At least, not most of the people I know who are very into free trade.
Sorry, you think they?
I don't think they accept that it will have bad ideas locally or bad impacts locally.
Well. You think, I mean, it seems to me that it's fairly obvious on the face of it that it will have to.
Oh, I mean, it has.
I mean, for example, one of the big issues on with Reagan, right, famously was the steel industry in the United States. And the steel industry in the United States was protected by tariffs, which protected it from steel coming in from the Far East. And other places, Brazil as well, I think, probably. And they said, you know, if you allow these products in, then you're going to have terrible effects on the steel industry in this state, that state, and the other state. And that you're talking about 150,000, 200,000 jobs and livelihoods that are going to be destroyed. And Reagan's response was, well, it may be true that unless those companies are willing to be more efficient and be more cost-effective and compete in the marketplace, but there are 200,000 people who make steel, but there are 5 million or 25 million people, I don't know, who actually use steel in their manufacturing. And they're being made less competitive by having to use more expensive steel than necessary. So say the car industry, the American car industry, was being penalized because it was having to use more expensive materials than it would otherwise have had. In the United Kingdom, the coal industry became uneconomic because it was possible to import coal from Poland, from Brazil and other places at a cheaper rate than it was to get coal out of the ground in Britain. And it's not that the Brits stopped using coal, they still used coal less than they did. And that had obvious catastrophic effects locally on local economies in Wales, in the northeast and the northwest of England, parts of Scotland. I don't see how you could hold it if you're going to do something which is going to damage or going to take away the possibility of trading from an industry that is not going to have an effect. It's going to have an effect.
Yeah, I'm not saying you're wrong. I think you're right. I'm just saying I know a lot of people who won't accept that. Because what they'll say is, well, you have to look at the wider context here and the second order consequences, and those people will go to other jobs, and the cheaper materials will lead to greater job growth. Unfortunately, I think if you look at America, particularly the states that run down the center of it, that doesn't appear to be exactly the case. Problem with thinking of the
Rust Belt,
the old Homo economists.
Yes, Homo economicus. Now, I suppose the point they're making is that in the long term, it will work out better.
I'm not even sure if that's...
Better
globally doesn't mean better nationally.
Well,
or better locally.
I suppose that the other thing libertarians would say is that, you know, we have now become attached to the idea that if you have a town or a city in a place that grew up because it was attached to an industry, and if that industry ceases to exist, then that town, but yet we expect that these towns will continue to exist. They would say, well, you know what? Historically, what happens is that when the salt stopped being taken out of the salt mine or the silver was finished in the silver mine, people just went somewhere else. We didn't expect centres of population would always perennially exist. Now, I think for a lot of people that sounds rather harsh. But, listen, whatever about the fact that the central point remains that we're talking about is that the notion that you protect a population from competition with other people from outside is not in itself a right-wing idea, but in fact an idea was put proper across the left, and a popular across the left across the board.
It is, like, I remember Uachtaráid and the endless think pieces about the rise of the far right in Ireland.
Yes.
And of course, yeah, there were some far right lads there. But there are about 200 far right people in Ireland. There are also numerous people from the far left there, by the way. You just didn't hear as much about them. But the fact that those people have those views is largely, I think, incidental to their actual right or left wing point. And when you poll people, I think that shows there's very, very many left-wing people who are very anti-immigration.
And is
now, they tend to be people of a particular socioeconomic class,
mm.
but they're absolutely left-wing. And considering most of the progressives would say it would be terribly classist to discriminate against someone based on their socioeconomic class, I couldn't imagine that they would make any comments as to levels of education or anything of that nature.
So are we saying that the people that tend to be anti-immigration are the people from the socioeconomic classes that perceive that they're going to be the people in competition for resources?
I think that would be probably an accurate way of putting it. Although generally I find that people tend to not put it that way. They tend to talk about education or isolated communities or monocultural communities rather than pointing out that these are the people who occupy most of the low-paying jobs and therefore the people most likely to be in direct competition with any new entry to the country.
So what they're actually saying to them is, listen, the opposition that these people have is actually based on a false idea. It's a false understanding of the situation, which is a consequence of their isolation and their low levels of education and sophistication, rather than simply admitting the fact that they occupy a particular place in the economic food chain, and that there is a very good chance that they will be economically impacted by the presence of these people competing.
Yeah, I think that's less because they don't want to go to these people and go, yeah, you might be screwed by this, and more because they legitimately don't believe that's what's going to happen.
Well, what do they think?
I most people, they believe things very deeply. But they know very little about those things. I mean, remember, Michael, we've done ideological kind of training days with students from both the left and the right. And you meet people with very strong views on both the left and the right. And you figure out very, very quickly that these people know fucking nothing. Regardless of if they're on the left or the right, they have a temperamental inclination to something.
Yes.
And they might know the slogans and they know the right things to say. But when you actually go, well, here's the philosophical backing of this, or here's the historical arguments, or the people who made what you are saying, those arguments, and here's why they said it, there's nothing there. I mean, particularly in relation to free speech.
Yeah.
People on both sides of that know absolutely nothing about why free speech is considered a fundamental value.
I remember one case in particular where we're dealing with a bunch of, objectively speaking, bright young people.
All university students.
Who are politically engaged. But when I started asking them, well, have you come across this book or that book? Texts which I would have regarded as pretty basic. I mean, not just basic for people interested in politics, but people with an interest in having a reasonably wide culture. Blank. And it became obvious, I think, as you remember, that as we talked to them, their political position was fundamentally emotional, or, if we like, temperamental. Now, that's probably true of all of us to a degree, that we are temperamentally inclined to be conservative or to be liberal.
And that's fine, if that, you know, to an extent that's true, but you know, if you're inclined towards something, you should study it. You should also study its opposition.
You should steel man, and that's the, I think, one of the big problems here is that rather than steel manning your opposition, they straw man it all the time.
But I'm mostly interested in why it's always far right, because there's research from the 2016 election where one of the apps, it collected information on voters and what they said their views were. And the purpose of the app was to tell you who to vote for. But it also harvested all that data for a research study. I think by a chap down in Limerick, who I've met, but I cannot for the life of me remember the name. It was actually a very good study.
That was a massive study, wasn't it?
And there were covered a third of the country fall into the authoritarian left category.
Yeah.
Which would tend to be socially conservative or socially authoritarian viewpoints, but left economically. The winning formula of populists in Europe: go left on the economy and then start talking the language of belonging.
Yeah.
But those people would tend to be quite rampantly anti-immigration. And a lot of the people I've met who are from, let's say, the Freedom Party or various other parties who are very strongly anti-immigration, or very strong, not anti-immigration, but very strong, very controlled borders. Very controlled borders. They're mostly on the left. The people I know who are right-wing, particularly the ones who are socially right-wing, don't tend to consider immigration a terribly pressing matter.
In Ireland?
Mostly because they've got so many other things to be concerned about.
I think if we look at the differences between England and Ireland, it's interesting. One of the things that makes it slightly more confusing, and if you're looking at the social, the socially conservative right in Ireland, which is getting smaller and smaller by the day, it would feel, is that you've got two types. Now, you may have some kind of old-fashioned authoritarian, bit suspicious of these people, more than a bit suspicious of these people, but you have a very large section of people who are seriously religious in that quadrant as well. And one of the things about Christianity is that Christianity is internationalist. And they are, because of the nature of the demographics here we're talking, they are largely Catholics. And again, Catholicism is an international organization and with an internationalist, globalist view regarding its outreach, but also the nature of humanity. And there's a long history of connection with the Third World through priests and nuns and brothers going out at a sense of responsibility and shared humanity and all that, which makes the whole thing ethically and morally for these people a more nuanced issue. You know, they do feel they have a moral duty to poor people or people who are in difficulty and people who are fleeing poverty and famine and war and all these things. So I think the religious element in the social right here, the socially conservative here, is confusing. But if you look at the stuff in England, I think it's very interesting. Steve Davis, you know Steve, he's the education director for the Institute of Economic Affairs in London and a friend of the Edmund Burke Institute's. Steve would say that's what actually, one of the reasons the confusion is happening with the commentators is because they haven't fully understood that what we are going through a moment in Western democracies, liberal democracies, where there's a shift happening within the politics, where the most important, what historically were the defining and important, the most defining important characteristics of your politics are changing. So if we look, say, at the vote in the north of England and parts of the Midlands in traditionally Labour seats, right, you have a lot of those seats where you have a strong Brexit vote, and a very strong Brexit vote amongst Labour voters. Now, when you dig down a bit, what you're finding is that these people have a traditional Labour view regarding the role of the state in intervening in the economy, in redistributing wealth, in providing goods and services for people, and making sure that everybody can access health and education and transport, and that kind of thing. But, for example, if you compare them to what we could call, rather than call them left-wing, let's call them progressives. in the urban areas in the southeast of England, and particularly in London, for them, things like the flag, the idea of the nation, the respect for the armed forces, respect for the police, these traditional values are very important to them. Their national identity is very important. They would see themselves very definitely as patriotic. They are patriotic Yorkshire men, Yorkshire women, and English men and English women. That's a very important part of their identity. Whereas if you were to ask people in the progressive element of the Labour Party in the South East, who are strongly Remainer, they don't have those attitudes. They don't see themselves. I remember talking to a group of young Labour voters, this quite some time ago, and they were far more comfortable, I thought this was curious, describing themselves as Londoners rather than describing themselves as British.
I think it was David Goodhart. He wrote a book called The Road to Somewhere.
Yeah.
And he argued that the actual split in politics that was developing was between what he called the anywheres and the nowheres.
Yes.
And he said the anywheres are those who have links to a community, whether it's a local community, a national community. They are, in some place, tied in place by those obligations.
Yes.
And the nowheres are simply people who, I mean, if you're in a certain strata, you can go between New York to Hong Kong, well, not Hong Kong at the minute, to Paris, to London, to various European cities, various Asian cities, and they're all pretty much interchangeable.
And they will tell you this, and they will tell you this proudly. Oh, listen, I feel it. I'm a citizen of the world.
Of the world.
I'm happy to be in Tokyo or Canberra or Paris or New York. It's all the same to me.
And I think there is actually an interesting point there. But if you're meant to care about the place you're in relation to laws and things of that nature, the ability to simply uproot and move somewhere else fundamentally changes that relationship.
But it also goes back to one of those temperamental differences between left and right. That people on the left temperamentally tend to be more open to new experience. Therefore they tend to be more creative. That's why artists and people involved in creative activities tend to be more left-leaning. Whereas people who are on the right tend to be rather more afraid, more nervous, less interested in new experience, and they like boundaries and borders, and boundaries and borders and are important to them in much so less so to the left. So they see these things. For example, I thought this was an interesting thing. I was reading a social psychology report recently, and it said that amongst a vast array of other things, differences between people on the left and the right was people on the right care more about their family. They put a high the differential between the value they place in their family and their friends, as opposed to the left. People on the left put a higher value on their friend group rather than their family group. And I thought that was an interesting insight. And I think that also gives you an insight into this differentiation. What Goodhart is talking is essentially the same thing as what Steve Davis is talking, because the change is happening on the right as well. For the 20th century, pretty well, the right was dominated by a particular kind of economic thinking, which was, if you like, the free market, fairly open borders, free trade, laissez-faire attitude.
It was, although...
yeah, listen, obviously, it's a curate's egg. It's a mixed bag.
Well, I think more that that is the big debate in conservatism, particularly in America. And in America, it looks like those people are losing power.
Well, Steve would say that in the United Kingdom, those people are losing power as well. That if you look at the economic policies, like the Tories today still talk in a certain way about Thatcher and the great Thatcherite revolution and all that. But they're talking about it but the reality of the kinds of policies they're implementing is far more spending, far less worry about borrowing, far more interventionist, more and distributionist, and that economically that there has been a real shift in at the heart of the Tories, and that they see that this is where the business is, that they can use their traditional social conservative values, but align them with the more, shall we say, left-leaning attitude to intervention in the economy. For example, Boris has introduced policies after Brexit, such as purchasing in, say, county councils and town councils will be done in such a way as to help local economies and local producers and manufacturers. Also, that at a national level, there will be a push to buy British or to buy English, depending where you are, buy Welsh, whatever. That's not the kind of, which would obviously be illegal under European law, but would not have been the kind of thinking that you would have classically had your Friedmanites.
It's the sort of thing that would be illegal under European law and would be absolutely overlooked if certain countries did it in certain cases, because certain countries do it.
Well, they do, but they do it far. To be fair, Gary, they do it an awful lot less. I mean, when I think it was Montini was the minister for the internal market, who drove through back in the '90s a hell of a lot of reforms, which made it much more difficult for local governments to give subsidies. Now you can still do it. And there's still and there's a certain amount of closed eyes going on, and there's a certain amount of vehicles where governments are given special circumstances to do it. But there's an awful lot less now than there would have been, say, 30 years ago.
I don't know. I think the right in Europe is moving in this direction anyway. They're purging the libertarian elements.
If you look at what we call the right in, say, Eastern Europe,
they've purged the libertarian elements.
There is very, very little libertarian about that. I mean, if you look at the case that, as you know, interests me particularly, if you look at what's going on in Italy today, the transformation of, say, the League, which is now becoming the dominant political force in the country in a way that it amazes me. When they started off first, the patron saint was a professor called Milio. And I would say that Milio's basic instincts would have been free market, libertarian, and local. This idea, you know, the famous idea that is supposed to be at the heart of Europe, but it never actually happens. The principle of subsidiarity, where power should go to the lowest possible point where it can be actually effectively executed. So you get as much local government as you possibly can. And only those decisions which have to be made at a higher level are made outside. Now, it seems to me the League is more and more moving away from that, more to this kind of authoritarian interventionist position. It's even actually abandoned its opposition to the euro. Now, which maybe there's a bit of the different kind of politics going on there. But Hungary, Slovakia, Poland, these countries. But the left there's always anti-globalism, right? Anti-globalism, you'd agree, is one of the classic motifs of the modern left, yeah? Anti-globalization, rather.
I at this stage, nearly pre-modern left. Because a lot of the modern left is not against globalisation. But you go back a couple of years. I mean, you don't even go back. Jeremy Corbyn. It's part of his little trouble now. That he's part of the wing of the left that's always hated the EU. Because the EU is a capitalist and intrinsically anti-socialist project. At least to their eyes. And to a certain degree they're right on that. But no, a lot of the modern left, particularly the more progressive wing, is not against globalization in any sense.
No, but that in a sense is that's what we're saying. I'm saying anyway is that what we're seeing is a fracture, that there isn't such a thing as the left. I would say there never was. For example, people when you talk about socialism, they always assume you're talking about some form of Marxism. But the English, there was always an endogamous and indigenous version of socialism. Of English socialism, which had nothing to do with Marxism, It's far more to do with utopian socialism and the Chartists that and the activity. And famously, it was said of the Labour Party that it was far more Methodist than it was Marxist. And that kind of social conscience, 19th century social conscience, English socialism is there. But there is no such thing as the left or the right. And that's becoming clear by these countries. Tony Blair, right? Tony Blair is the leader of the Labour Party, so he is a man of the left.
Oh, yes. Tony Blair, the man who just... What was the phrase from the Conservatives? He rewrote our manifesto and delivered it in a better suit.
Yeah. Well, no, he actually did actually commit explicitly to the economic policies that Ken Clark were pursuing. He wasn't going to change the direction. He said that as a sop to the markets, I suppose. But Tony Blair would have been perfectly comfortable with globalization. Bill Clinton, man of the left, would have been very happy with globalization. Schroeder in Germany, that kind of left seems to be in retreat now.
I think you have a... Conservatism is... The right is splitting in interesting ways, and the left is splitting in interesting ways. The left seems to hold the dominant cultural power, particularly amongst cultural elites, so they're very overrepresented in media.
Yes.
Is that the issue here? Is that why everything is far right? Because everyone thinks of themselves as kind of centrist. And you have people who are... slightly to the right of Stalin.
Well, yes, I think that there's that. If you remember, I observed at the time of the Brazilian general election that Bolsonaro was being described as all sorts of kinds of things, hard right, far right, extreme right, etc. His opposition for the role of president and vice president, the vice presidential candidate was a member of the Brazilian Communist Party, brackets, Marxist-Leninist, close brackets, yet was never referred to as being far left on any of the reports I saw in the media here or in the papers. It was always described as left wing. Now, if being a Communist Party member, brackets, Marxist-Leninist, doesn't put you on the far left, I don't know where you're going with language. So yes, I think you're right that these people will not see themselves unless they're involved in actual revolutionary parties. They will not see themselves as deeply radical.
It's an interesting one because it's a strategic blindness that if you were in their position and you wanted your views to be ascendant, you would want to stamp out. Because if you can't see the problem, if you cannot accurately determine its nature, it's very difficult to deal with it. So if these people keep going around and saying that this is the far right, that's the far right, those people are far right, that village is far right, when a lot of those people are going to be left-wing, like old-school Sinn Féin voters.
Yes.
It's not helpful for them. It's primarily helpful for the people who are actually far right.
Yeah, but do you not think that there's... I mean, I think there's a couple of things. I think there's a almost conscious effort here as well to do what happened in the last century, at the end of the last century here, which is to shift the centre, to define this, to get people to understand where the centre is differently. Explain to the... You have a better grasp what the Overton window is.
So there's two different types of Overton window, but in this context, it would refer to, if you imagine the political compass, and for those who probably should have explained what the political compass is for those, if you imagine two lines, one line runs horizontal, one line runs vertically through the centre of the horizontal line. And on the horizontal line, on the left you have left, on the right you have right. And on the top of the vertical line, you have authoritarian. On the bottom of it, you have libertarian. And you basically have four quadrants made out by that. So you have left authoritarian, left libertarian, right libertarian. And where you are in that quadrant will determine how right or left wing you are and how authoritarian or libertarian you are. The Overton window is basically a segment of that political compass. It could be anywhere on it. And it basically says views within this space are not only sane and reasonable, they are accepted. They are the default views at this time. And the closer you get to the edge of the Overton window, the less and less acceptable the views become. And if you go over the edge of the Overton window, what you're saying is not just wrong, it's either evil, offensive, or simply nonsense. It just does not fit with the cultural and political narrative to such an extent it's totally unacceptable. And so moving the Overton window is a strategy of basically putting as much effort, trying to determine where the edge of that window is and doing things in that area so that the edge becomes the centre, and then you move to the new edge, and you basically over time make your opponent's ideas not just wrong, but totally nonsensical, just absolutely unacceptable to argue for.
You get to the point where the opponent's ideas are either bad or mad.
Yeah, generally.
And I think it seems to me to be beyond argument that if we look at social issues in Ireland, the Overton window in the last 15 years has just skidded across the axis.
In some ways it has. However, I would suspect that while the Overton window has very much gone against social conservatives for a while, they are now on issues like abortion, and I would suspect euthanasia, largely outside of it. Interestingly enough, you can have socially conservative libertarians as well, who are always fun. The Irish people, yeah, will go in a certain direction on this. I don't think that's very deep, though. I think it's basically a puddle. It's very wide support for things.
I think you might be right. It's a mile wide, but an inch.
I think the Overton window, if it were to start moving back the other way, if there were media organisations such as Gripped, which you can donate money to online, who could pull it back in the other direction, I think it would change quite easily. Or at least we'd have a fight about it. Whereas, I mean, did you see, I think Micheál Martin mentioned it in The Dáil. He said that he was complaining about someone, I think it was Grealish, had made comments. I don't think it was Rona Murphy, it was a while ago. And he had said that all of the parties have agreed we won't use immigration as a political message. And people came out and said, you know, that's a sign of our political maturity and you know, how welcoming a country we are. It's not a sign, it's a sign of political infantilization. That we'd simply say this is an issue important to the public, but we're all just going to agree we're not going to deal with it.
Because the public are essentially children and will not be able to deal with this properly. And it would be in the same way as you wouldn't give a child a box of matches to play with. We won't give the public this issue.
It's if you start talking about, let's say, negative impacts of migration, even in the context of saying there are positive impacts and they might be greater, you're done. You can't do it because, you know, people will get it into their heads and you can't trust people. And that's kind of the sense of it. But I mean, I am interested if I think you could be right that this is in part an effort to just say far right so much that the people who espouse those views are just automatically viewed as far right. However, in the last 10 years, I have noted a distinct weakening of the power of the phrase far right to frighten people who are not political.
You think?
I think 10, 20 years ago, far right in Ireland carried a lot more sting in the tail than it does now.
I suppose so many people have been called Nazis that at this stage, it just feels like rhetoric.
Yeah, I mean, it's like if someone is called racist. So many people are nowadays called racist for things that are either totally innocuous or would at worst be kind of a clunky statement.
I think that's very much the one. I was talking to a few Fine Gaelers here locally about the Verona case, not to constantly be baiting up on poor Verona, And their reaction was, and I don't, now I'm an elderly white man, so I'm not really maybe in a position to make this judgment, but these are not people that I have ever heard express views that you could describe as being xenophobic or racist. They're just very ordinary, nice, decent people, compassionate, reasonable people. And they were really upset at their perception that Verona had been thrown under the wheels of the bus. And more than one said to me, I thought we still had something like free speech in the country. Is everybody going to be interrogated now before they can do anything? You'd have to fill in a 500 questionnaire before you can get to stand for the town council. So I think there's a sense that they, even if people looked at what Verona said and they thought, you know what, some of it was silly and some of it was badly expressed, but if you have people saying, there was an article in one of the papers today, straight out, xenophobe, racist, giving respectability to xenophobia. People look at that and they see this attached to Verona. They look at what she said, and what they're thinking in their hearts is, well, if they could say that about her, they could very easily say exactly the same thing about me.
There is this, like, someone will be called racist in a prominent newspaper. I'll hear it and I'll be like, now do you mean, like, racist racism? Or just, like, they made a suggestion you didn't like and could be construed in a certain way with absolutely no charity? And when you have to start making that distinction, it just means that, you know, legitimate racists, like people who are deep in there, are getting a far easier ride. Because, like, no, they're racist. And you're like, yeah, but like actual racism?
I wonder sometimes, we haven't discussed this, so it's not fair to throw it at your head, as it were, but it does seem to me that a lot of the language and, shall we say, the ideological or analytical tools that are associated with this kind of positioning, we have imported, not just ourselves, but ourselves, the British, and other people in the Anglophone, have imported from the United States.
Mm.
Which has a completely different history on this subject and a completely different experience. But they're bringing all of the assumptions and all of the ideas and the experiences and historical assumptions from the United States and plonking them into Ireland.
It does. And it's been, you can hear it particularly in the way it looks at race. Because they talk about race in a way that only really makes sense in American context, where you had traditionally one particular colour, and firstly, American racism is largely predominated by skin colour, which in Europe was not traditionally how it was done. It was more nationality and religion.
Yeah.
So, and also American racism, because of the power structures, you can argue is much more unilinear. It runs from one people to the other. And even if the other people are racist, the power differential is so large that at a macro level, it doesn't really matter. Now, I don't think that's an accurate summary of the situation, yeah, but you can at least make the argument.
And also, I mean, not to miss the obvious, it's a state which, until 1860, had a massive slave economy. And the great majority of African-Americans today, Black Americans today, are the descendants of people who are slaves. This is a country which was built on it, and then lived in states where, until the 60s and 70s, Jim Crow laws actively were complicit in maintaining them in a position of powerlessness and of poverty, with the active collusion of the government, and that just wasn't the case. I mean,
no, but then when you hear them talking about it in Europe, and particularly Ireland, and they're talking about it, the structures they think racism abides by don't make sense in the Irish context. And you can, it's very obvious that this is something that has been imported, very roughly hammered into place. It doesn't really fit. But you don't have this sort of skin-based unidirectional racism in Ireland.
Well, at least it's not identical anyway. That's,
no, and it's not structural.
No, it's not systemic. That's not to say that there are not people in Ireland who are racist. And let's remember, as animals, there's a part of us which, uncontrolled and unmitigated, is very suspicious of things which don't look like us.
I mean, I sent you that poem that Simon Harris put up earlier on Twitter.
Oh, God.
It is terrible poetry. And actually, I will read it for the listener.
Oh, don't.
It's called Taught Racism. Simon Harris put this up, and he said it was worth reflecting on, and it was the responsibility of political and media discourse to create a country of inclusion and tolerance and respect. But here is the poem. It's by a guy called Willow Moon Pierce, who is apparently a man. Children are born blind to hate and bigotry, with their big smiles and loving ways. They are taught ugliness by unthinking adults and overheard conversation. This makes them use words and terms that for generatio, I assume that's meant to be generations and he's cut this out somehow, have caused hate and bitterness to our fellow man. Yes, they are taught, not born, to this social cancer. I once asked a black friend how he would like to be addressed. Black, Afro-American, or just coloured? No, he said, just call me friend. A government minister sent that out.
Oh, sweet Jesus. I mean, okay, leaving aside the... Was there not another... If he wanted to express that idea, could he not have found a poem about the universal humanity which was better than that?
I mean, could he not have found a poem by a black man? Well, or a woman?
Could he not have found a poem by Langston Hughes or Maya Angelou or somebody, for crying out loud?
Anyone could.
James Baldwin.
The thing I love about this is children... There's a research on children where they say that children they're blind to bigotry or preferences or anything we would consider racism. They're not. The research on very, very young children. Children have a really strong sense of the in-group, out-group, based on their views of their parents. So children will strongly prefer, if you show them different faces, different people with the same skin colour as their parents. Because humans have an innate sense of in and out group. So that was actually... I took this and I just ignored the fact it was terrible poetry. It's totally wrong. Which is not to say that this is something that should exist, but it is largely based on human tendencies and human nature. And if you refuse to accept that and you start building societies that don't realise that and try and channel it into other things, largely by giving people overarching identities which they can then use to effectively channel these into more positive terms, you kind of tear yourself apart pretty quickly. That was the joy of nationalism.
It's not to the point of this, but it packaged in all of this imported notion is I've heard people talk about, for example, the need to give reparations because we have, through our enjoyment and exercise of white privilege, built our wealth on the suffering of Africa.
Yeah, I've heard that as well.
Now, I can kind of understand where that's coming from in the United States. I can see there's an argument, whether or not it's a good argument or a bad argument, but it's in Ireland. Or in fact, again, going back, the south of Italy was depopulated in the period sort of like between the 17th and 19th century. A large parts of it were depopulated because North African pirates kept coming along and taking the people away and selling them into slavery. Around 1.25 million people were taken into slavery by the Corsair pirates from Tripoli over a couple of centuries. And that doesn't include the Moroccans. In the heart of it seems to be the notion that racism is the exclusive purview of white people.
Which I don't think anyone who's ever had, let's say, a conversation with anyone who's Chinese about black people. But they've redefined racism. Before, racism was racial animosity. It was the definition of racism you find in, let's say, some of the UN documents. And they've changed it to prejudice plus power. And then they argue that minorities don't have power, which is firstly false, particularly on a micro level. So they've changed, instead of talking about racism, they've changed structural racism to be the default. And even then, a terribly just bastardized, not even terribly intellectually sound version of structural racism.
Whatever is happening, it seems to me that if there's no strong evidence anyway that there is any kind of vaguely significant organized right, far right, happening in Ireland today. It just doesn't exist. There are a few hundred people wandering around, and they go from party to party to group to group. They form and they disform. And in a weird way, all of this talk and all of this concentration on them, which we've seen, again, it's the speed of these things happening these days. A couple of years ago, this really wasn't an issue. In the last 12 months, suddenly, we start, and the last 3 months, certainly, all of these articles and conversations about the fear of the rise of the right and the far right doing this, ironically, it seems to me the only thing that this is likely to do is actually to give power to the far right, to give them a credibility and a credence. In lots of studies that have been done on our on the way that we have accepted and integrated non-native into the population, we have 17% of the population today in Ireland are people who are not born here, right? Which I think is the highest percentage in the EU. The reality is that when the studies have been done, is that we've actually done remarkably well.
Incredibly well, particularly considering the speed it happened at.
Yeah.
And you're talking about a few decades, and Ireland went from a country that was unbelievably homogeneous to one that has a great variety of races in it, with very, I'm not going to say no, but effectively the racial friction that happened was largely at individual level.
We have not seen any sign of the successful genesis of an anti-immigration or party or a xenophobic party. There's no indication that these are having any traction at all. And even when they have traction, it seems to me that when you talk to some of the people who read some stuff they're talking about, it isn't even a lot of them, it's not really about race, about foreigners. It's a whole panoply of issues that they're worried about. And it's frankly, a slightly paranoid way of looking at the world.
I've noticed a lot of the people who are putting this out most are people who would be in the sort of, not even the progress, more the Antifa space.
Yeah.
And the problem with Antifa is that if there are no fascists, Antifa has no purpose. And movements like Antifa tend to draw people in who don't have a lot going on with their lives. As in, they may have certain things that appear good, but they tend to lack purpose. The old Nietzsche quote, that a man who has a why will find a how. These are people who will often have acute education and sometimes money, but don't really have any reason to do so. They've no why. And it gives them a why, and then you're part of a group. But to that group to continue, there needs to be fascists.
Yeah, and one thing that if you listen to people like Jonathan Haidt, he'll tell you, we are, number one, we are, as animals, we are incredibly groupish. We really feel much happier and more comfortable when we belong to a group. And we are also animals built for purpose. We like to have a meaning. We like to have purpose. We like to have what Aristotle would have called a telos, an end, something that we are working towards, to an achievement which we can move. And that's what, I mean, these groups, I suppose, for certain people, will perform that role. But yes, if you're anti-fa and you have no fas out there, you have to create them.
I mean, you just, if you're an anti-fa and there's no actual fascists, you're just a loser.
Listen, it's essentially what we're talking about is what Cervantes is talking about, is Quixote. Don Quixote wants to go out and battle giants, so he ends up tilting at windmills because he can't find, there are no giants left, there are no dragons to slay. So if you can't find a dragon or a giant, you'll invent them.
Yeah, I mean, there are people in Ireland who have legitimate fascist tendencies, which is actually different than Nazi tendencies, just as a point of actual importance.
Yes.
People may say that's not important. It's actually quite annoying when people, because there's many different types of fascism.
It's so annoying. I was watching a lecture on YouTube the other day, which was an academic, apparently quite a well, from the comments, he seemed to be quite a well-known academic, talking about analysis of the ideology of fascism. And he basically conflated the fascists and the Nazis and talked about them both as a counter-enlightenment philosophies. Which Nazism, well, maybe, but fascism is not.
I assume he made the old romantics line of argument.
Well, to an extent, but I think the romantics are children of the Enlightenment. They're not reactions to the Enlightenment. Wordsworth is and these boys are great fans of the Revolution. Wordsworth actually changes his mind, but others don't. Right, yeah.
There are legitimately people in Ireland who do have fascist ideologies. Generally not well developed. Like, these are not people who are going to be like, well, you know, I'm right because Carol Schmitt said it.
No, they're not sitting down and reading Gentile at night and thinking, yeah, there's a...
No, weirdly enough, Carol Schmitt is very popular with the Chinese Communist Party.
Which is... Carl Schmitt is a German jurist for those
chief jurist of the Third Reich, basically.
For the three people in Ireland who haven't heard of Carl Schmitt, he was a conservative jurist. He was Catholic. What caused problems for him in his post-war life was the fact he ended up in a very serious senior judicial position during the Nazi period, and people have wondered, and a very reasonable thing to wonder. How can you do that and be a reasonable person? But anyway, he wrote a lot about jurisprudence and about law and philosophy of law and the nature of the state and stuff. And he is apparently, Gary tells me, I didn't know this, enormously popular in China.
His work is being translated into Mandarin. And there's actually some good papers on it.
Well... I suppose.
Niche area, I suppose. But yeah, these are not people who've read people like that or Vogler, even though Vogler is a bit of a weird one, and come to these ideas. But there are people like that. There's a couple of hundred of them in the country.
Vogler wasn't a fascist.
No, Vogler was just weird.
I mean, let's face it, he was the guy that criticised the SS for not being sufficiently hardcore.
Yeah, I do like the fact that they met him once and were like, man's a nutter.
And he was.
This is a man who went for, he would walk through cities that were under active aerial bombardment.
Yeah.
Just to see what it was like. He eventually ended up being crippled by a bomb.
It was in Vienna, wasn't he? He walked around Vienna.
I'm not sure if it was Vienna, but I think we can all expect that a man who will walk through a city being actively bombed during World War II because he thought it was a pleasant environment is either very, very solid on his self-belief or just not great.
I think the technical term is looper. Anyway, Gary, when the revolution comes, and wherever it comes, if it comes from the right, do you think, will we be safe, or will we be carted off to the camps on the corner?
I suppose it depends what shade of the right. As I've said to other people, I do hold, I do have a great spark of hope in any eventual revolution that comes from the left. Because I know that while I may be put up against a wall and shot, a lot of the people who are currently arguing that I should be, or who will argue that I should be, will be going right against that wall shortly thereafter.
Yeah.
And I take a degree of solace in that, Michael. Because I hate to lose, but if they die as well, I've taken it to a draw.
There's always the comfort in remembering that Monsieur Guillotine survived the revolution, but Robespierre did not. I think I mentioned before, but Robespierre, who was responsible for large chunks of the terror, I love the fact that he was actually opposed in principle to the death penalty.
Yeah, ah, the French Revolution.
And I'm sure when they come to shoot us, when they come to line us up against the wall, they'll do so with a heavy heart. Because in principle, they agree that, you know, they're against capital punishment.
Yeah, but it'll be some vegan wearing tweed who won't hurt anything that has a shadow.
No, vegans wouldn't wear tweed.
Oh, good point, yeah.
Nylon. Ghastly nylon jackets.
That's not environmental, though.
Hemp, then.
Hemp.
Hemp trousers and hemp shoes and hemp jacket. Roll them up, light, set them on fire, and you have a good doobie.
Yeah, they'll rouse themselves from their iron deficiency long enough to put the bullet down range.
Anyway, Gary, I think it's time.
Blindfold on or off, Michael, if you were to be shot by firing squad?
I'm not sure about that, but I'll tell you one thing I'm certain of. I'll take the cigarette.
I mean, I think blindfold off, because if I'm going to die by bullet, I should at least be able to stare into the eye of the man who did it and emotionally traumatise him for life.
Yeah. All I know is if at that stage I might as well have the fight, because it's not going to do me a whole lot of harm. So, blindfold's good, I don't know. My preferred position would be the other side of the wall. I have no doubt, Gary, if the revolution comes, I will be the guy there on his knees, absolutely saying, I welcome the advent of our Google overlords, please. I will go through whatever self-criticism they want. I will endure whatever re-education is necessary. Anything that will save my useless skin, I will be willing to do. I don't see myself looking back at history thinking, you know what, I would have been a hero. No, I would have been the guy at the back thinking, if I do this, they'll shoot me for desertion. So how can I, what's the best way?
What's the best way to get through this war? Yes. Being at the front or shop or being too far behind?
I love the story C.S. Lewis tells in his biography, his little biography, where he says he's, like, as a university graduate, he was automatically enrolled as an officer, junior officer, lieutenant. And junior officers, you remember, actually had the highest fatality rates of any group in the First World War. Anyway, he's sitting in a trench, and as it was very often the case in different parts of the line, some parts of the line, they never saw any action, basically, for years. But anyway, wherever they were, it was very quiet, it had been quiet for some time. And then they noticed over beyond a little bit of activity and maybe the slight flicker of a flame or something, somebody lighting a cigarette. And he said to his sergeant, who was a professional soldier, been in the army for many years, he was a yeoman from Somerset or something like that, Zummerzet. And he suggested to the army, what should we pop a rifle grenade over in there? Because we think there are people there. And the sergeant replied carefully, well, sir, we can do that if you want. But the thing is, we have found in the past, if we do that to them, they tend to do that back to us. At which point Lewis took the point that maybe it was best let sleeping dogs lie. And nothing was done. It's an eminently sensible thing to do. And I would have been very much the guy, don't do anything. If they don't shoot at us, we won't shoot at them.
Yeah, and then you just avoid try and avoid getting shot by the Jaegers.
Anyway, we shall return, I suppose, on Wednesday, God willing, and the revolution not having intervened. But until then, we wish you a good Monday and a good beginning of the week. And enjoy the music, which Gary seems to be enjoying tremendously.
Of course. All the best.
Bye-bye.